Code number MEFESH98-28. Copyright 1998, all rights reserved. The International Network of Orthodox Mental Health Professionals presents The Challenges of Treating Our Own with Elliot Kranzler, M.D., Benzion Sorotskin, Doctor of Psychology, and Yitzhak Schechter, Ph.D. Recorded live at the third annual conference held May 21st through 24th, 1998, at the Homerock Resort Hotel, Glens Falls, New York. Now let's begin this informative session.
Let me start by thanking all of you for joining in this session this morning, and perhaps for curtailing your breakfast, because in a hotel, a breakfast can go on. We who work in the mental health professions with the Frum population are constantly aware of how the religious patient is dealing on a day-to-day basis with the impact of his religious and spiritual life, and how that weaves into his emotional and psychological being. And I think that Orthodox patients are interested in seeing from therapists because they know that a therapist needs to understand the subtleties, the nuances of their thinking and of their experience day to day. So I'm pleased to be a part of a panel with two wonderful colleagues, one whom I had met over the phone many times previously, and one whom I met for the first time this Shabbos. We'll begin by hearing from Dr. Benzion Sorotskin. Let me start off by saying that having worked with patients of Dr. Sorotskin, I know the tremendous impact that he has. I know the tremendous respect with which he's held, and I'm the beneficiary of that. Dr. Sorotskin received his doctorate in clinical psychology from Yeshiva University. He lived in Israel for 7 years, where he worked as a psychologist at the Youth Aliyah Psychology Clinic, and he also served as a psychologist in the Israel Defense Forces as part of his Army Reserve duties. He has a particular area of interest in perfectionism, and he's published articles in the journal Psychotherapy on the psychology and free will in Jewish periodicals. For the past 12 years, he's been working in private practice as a clinical psychologist in Brooklyn. And today, Dr. Sorotskin is going to be talking about understanding and treating perfectionism in religious adolescence.
Thank you. I'm going to stand right there.
First of all, I would like to express Hakaras HaTov to Nefesh, for this first time I've been at the conference, and now I feel bad I missed the other two. It's been some experience, and like Ellie said, I think this has been meeting the voice behind the voicemail. We've exchanged many messages. I send many patients to Ellie for psychiatric consultations and medication. And likewise, one of the reasons I finally got to him is because I try to be very sensitive to my patients, and not all referrals have... some have come back with complaints, and I only hear the highest praise when I send them to Ellie. It's like it's a wonderful thing. So we've had a wonderful working relationship, and I was glad to finally see the face behind the voice. And also with Yitzhak, likewise, I've only met him for the first time this Shabbos, and I think we already hit up a wonderful relationship, and I think it was worth coming here just to meet them both in person. So I'm really glad and thankful to Nefesh for giving me this opportunity. One of the themes of one of the major themes in this year's convention was children going off the derech, teenagers going off the derech. I think it's as I was listening, I went to a wonderful full day event on Friday on this issue of going off the derech, and it struck me that my topic also deals with kids going off the derech, but they're not going off the derech in the sense of leaving religion; they're going off the derech emotionally. Maybe they're too much on the derech. Maybe we can put it that way. You know, so the different kids react to stress in different ways. Some go off the derech and some really dig deep into the derech or fly high with it. I'm not sure exactly how to put it. So I would like to begin my presentation by speaking about describing to you four patients that came to me within the recent 4 months, because this problem seems to me also to be a magefa, like they spoke about children going off to dera. We're talking about kids, adolescents or young adults, who very often were doing great. They were doing fantastic. They were the best kids in the shiur. That's usually how they presented. The parent comes, this kid was the best. He was the most wonderful. He was never angry his whole life. Till, you know, it's like unbelievable how great it was. And suddenly the person becomes dysfunctional. Often, sometimes it's a nervous breakdown. Sometimes it's somatic complaints. All kinds of different ways the person suddenly falls apart. And although they seem to have very different symptoms, I want to suggest that they have an underlying theme to their symptoms that ties them together. So I'll begin with the first one, whom we'll call Avram. He presented with the most severe symptoms of this group. He's a 19-year-old yeshiva bacher, very down on life, very depressed. He has wandered from yeshiva to yeshiva, never finding his place. He tends to be isolated and withdrawn. He's barely functioning. Actually, I had seen him 3 years ago for one session when his parents brought him, but he refused to continue. And even now, he's quite resistant to the idea of therapy, but feels desperate, and therefore was willing to come. The second patient, whom we'll call Bracha, is a very successful 25-year-old married teacher with children, who is teaching in a Beis Yaakov-type school. And she has been highly functional in all areas, but suffering from excruciating headaches for 3 years, nonstop, chronic, practically with no relief. She has tried every sort of treatment known to mankind, conventional, non-conventional, with absolutely no relief. And nonetheless, she continues functioning on a super level. The third patient, whom we call Chaim, is an 18-year-old yeshiva bacher who was a pretty mediocre student in his elementary school days. He went to Israel, and it sometimes happens, really got into it, got into learning, was flying high. He came back, continued in a high-level yeshiva, was doing great for 6 months, and suddenly he started suffering from weakness, tiredness, diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And he's become very depressed, and he still plows ahead. He pushes. It's not enough to learn during Seder. He has to learn between Ben Azdarim, even though those yeshivas tell him not to. And he's very frustrated. The main reason he's coming to therapy is because he's desperate to return to his former level of functioning, and would come 6 days a week and probably walk in on Shabbos if I would tell him that would make him get better. David, who the third patient who we'll call David, is a 29-year-old, highly successful professional. I'm sorry? You're right, I forgot how to count. Okay, the fourth patient, thank you, is a 29-year-old, highly successful professional. He was a star student, both in his religious and his secular studies. He referred himself because he's having a very difficult time getting married, in spite of countless dates, 2 broken engagements, and no shortage of suitable young ladies eager to marry him. Now the question is there a common theme among this disparate group of patients who seem to have very different symptoms? And I think the common theme is perfectionism. Because perfectionism colors the way a person experiences themselves, the way they experience the world. And makes otherwise difficult symptoms crystal clear. So regarding these four patients, Avram, his perfectionism was very obvious, unlike the other patients. As was his related grandiosity. He feels he's spiritually superior to the other students in the yeshiva. And therefore, the goals and accomplishments that are okay for them are not okay for him at all. He's at a much higher level. And he's very upset that other people don't see it. He's currently learning in a yeshiva for boys who have difficulties, which is pretty much a narcissistic injury for him. But what really shocks him, he told me this with all seriousness, he can't believe how the two Rosh Yeshivas didn't understand on their own that they should come over to him and ask him to learn with them during Seder. One should ask for first Seder, and one should ask for the second Seder. It's mind-boggling how they haven't figured that out. Now, on the other hand, he's aware that he's barely been functioning for the last few years. He's not psychotic, right? In his own words, he says, I want to be the best, but I feel I'm the worst. Now, how does he explain this? He can rationalize this. He's saving his energy for the big push, right? When he starts flying high, he's going to need a lot of energy. So it's okay that he's not functioning now because he has to save it up his energy. Now, as I said, he rejects the suggestions of his rabbanim, his Rosh Yeshiva, that he should slow down, that he should develop some more suitable goals for his present level of functioning. But you see, he really can't do that. And it makes a lot of sense once you understand how perfectionism works. Because for a regular, you know, if you want to learn how to play tennis, you have no clue, you never play tennis. You start playing, and you don't play very well, right? But it's okay, because you know you just started, and you're working toward your goal. You see, but by perfection is doing a little bit of something big is absolutely nothing. It has no connection. It has no shaykhis, as they say in yeshiva. Right? So you're talking about two separate things. So for him to do a little bit of something like his Rebbeim suggests to him just doesn't make any sense to him, because what connection does that have to do to his grandiose goals? Now, with most patients, unlike Avram, the perfectionism is not at all clear. It is not presented in the presentation. And the only way... Now, for two reasons. One reason is because the patient has no clue. You know, if I sometimes don't have clue, the patient certainly has no clue, because they don't make any connection between their symptom and the perfectionism. The second reason is because they're embarrassed, because the paradox is like this. The lower you're actually functioning, the higher your grandiosity has to go. It's zulumazu. It's like a scale. It has to balance out. So the patient you find with the lowest self-esteem, you can probably imagine, has the highest illusions of grandiosity. The patient, I was reminding myself of a patient I treated years ago who had self-esteem at furthest, lowest level I've ever seen it. So I was not shocked when months later, he confided in me that he sometimes feels he's greater than Hashem. And he thought I'd fall off my chair, but I was actually waiting for him to say it. So, so what happens is, so that's one reason. So they're very embarrassed. There's a lot of shame connected to those fantasies, and therefore, they don't describe it. Now, so how do you pick it up? Because when you struggle to try, like you pick up anything else in therapy, is when you struggle to understand the meaning of the symptom. Just mamash, I think this happened the day before I came up here. A patient who I'm seeing for the second time. He comes in, he's very sad, but doesn't seem classically depressed, but very down. And something amazing he said to me. Maybe he knew I was coming to the home act to speak on the subject, probably. Maybe it was Yoan Novi, actually. All right, but anyway. So he says like this. So he says, you know, I ask him, you know, what's the main issue you want to work on? So he says, my biggest problem is I don't want to live. Now, but he's not saying like a suicidal patient says, look, I want to kill myself. Nothing like that. It had a whole different quality. I'm thinking, like, I'm scratching my head, like, what is he telling me? And there's nothing, he's had a lot of problems in his life, you know, not surprisingly, but he's actually, his life now is pretty well. He has a job in learning, which he always wanted to do. He has a very wealthy father, so he has no, you know, panosa problems. He had problems with his wife, but they've gone to marriage counseling for a long time, and things have settled down. And I'm trying to... So then he said even more. He says, you know, and really something about it, I don't understand why other people want to live. Like, he's really asking a serious question. I should explain to him why other people want to live. Like, to him it seems like a pretty wild thing. Like, why would a person want to live? And again, not with the quality of depression or feeling that things are horrible in my life and I can't go on. It's like, why would a person want to live? But if you understand the perfectionist, it makes sense. Because how often can you do something perfectly well, even if you tried hard? You know, like once every 6 months, if you're lucky. So what's the reason for living the other times? Because everything you do is so totally worthless. So all his achievements, he teaches boys Torah, which is what he wants to do. But, you know, it really doesn't mean much because it's really old stuff that I learned already before. It's like, really, what's the big deal? So is it amazing he doesn't want to live? Now, the third patient, Bracha, is actually one of the patients who was referred to me, the way she came to me with excruciating headaches. She came to me, was sent to me by Dr. John Sarno. I don't know how many of you are familiar with him. He's become very popular in the Frum community lately. He works a lot with chronic. He's actually an orthopedic surgeon in the Rusk Institute. Started out as a classical, you know, doing back surgeries and treating back pains that way. Amazingly enough, just through his experience, he has absolutely no psychological training, which he always says and writes, but he discovered that he came to the conclusion that most of these patients are suffering from emotional stress. And not just the regular stress that other doctors talk about, but he spoke about narcissism, repressed rage. You all discovered this when working with patients. I actually went to myself with back pain. I was a few years ago, and that's how I got introduced to him, and I showed him a paper, because he speaks a lot about perfectionism as being a cause of major stress in life. So I showed him a paper I wrote on the subject quite a few years ago, and since then he's referred a lot of patients to me, Although most patients he feels he can deal with without sending them to therapy, but the ones who do need, he just wrote a book actually, came out 2 weeks ago, it's his third book, called The Mind-Body Prescription. Right. It's an excellent book. It's a good thing to get patients who have somatic conditions. He's probably rediscovered psychosomatic medicine, which has been out of vogue for a while. Well, one reason I'm pushing the book is he quotes me in the book. A patient called me up all excited. I didn't even know about it, even though it came up. And the patient called me all excited to let me know. Anyways, that's how she came to me. She saw him once. He told her this, and this is all due to repressed feelings and stress. She accepted it reluctantly, but came. It was amazing how unaware she was of her stress. She really questioned. She says, I have no stress in my life. It turned out she has years of repressed rage, terrible conflicts in the family. She tells me that till today, if she opens it, when her husband opens up the bill from the credit card company, she just can't tolerate. She can't look. Because she remembers what her father used to go into rages when if the mother spent $10, you know, out of the cheshbon and came on the Visa bill, he'd just go off the wall. Until this day she suffers. But she doesn't suffer from any stress. So she has tried to deal with all this by being the perfect daughter. You know, it was interesting. I started working with her before Pesach, before she went home, and it was really a very interesting event. Anyway, so she became a super good person. Super good daughter, super good husband, super good balas chesed, all while suffering from excruciating headaches. Chaim, who was supposedly suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome, he had the hardest time remembering anything emotionally meaningful in his life, from the past, present, or any time. He desperately wanted to be helped, and had no clue what I'm talking about. What do you mean how I felt about something? He didn't understand what all that meant. You gotta start from A, like what the word feeling means. But he's trying very hard to be cooperative, so he's working at it. So he started describing that he had, over a period of a few weeks, he tells me that he's always had these horrible relations with his father, his sister has a horrible relationship with the mother, the parents have a horrible relationship with each other. He realizes now, it took him all this time to figure out why he always tries not to be home ben azman, and to go somewhere else. He's thinking of going the summer to Israel, not to have to be home. But he has no stress in his life. Now he says he used to argue with his father. He used to get into these massive fights with him. But then, I don't know, somehow, I'm not sure exactly why yet, but he decided to change all that. That's it. He's going to avoid. Avoidance, that's the way to go. He's going to be a good boy. He's not going to be chutzig anymore. He's going to avoid everything. So basically what he avoids is he avoids his feelings. And that's how he does it. He's become extremely unassertive at home, in yeshiva. He described to me how when now he's trying to get a little in touch with what's going on. So he describes he's only with a chavrusa, and they're trying to figure out a taisus, and he's thinking, and the chavrusa's humming a niggin, right? And it's disturbing him. It's like very annoying. I said, well, did you ask him if he doesn't, you know, mind not singing? Oh no, he might think I'm angry. So that's, you know, that's the stress he's under. Now what's happening is, because in order to repress feelings, like I sometimes explain to my patients, feelings, unlike the electrical circuits at home, we can shut off just one circuit of one part of the house or just a few plugs. I think in the human mind, there's only one master switch. And if you repress feelings in order not to have to deal with unacceptable and intolerable feelings, you end up having no energy. So is it a wonder that he can't study, can't learn, that he feels weak all the time? In fact, I think many kids who are, you know, perhaps it's possible, some of the people who are learning disabled might be actually be repressing their feelings. Of course, not a shocking thought for the people here. All right, now, since, again, as I said, since for the perfectionist, anything less than perfect is totally worthless, so although he's really pushing himself, and he's probably learning better than most of the guys in the yeshiva, he feels he's doing absolutely nothing, and he desperately has to get back on track. David, who was having trouble finding a shidduch, who actually said, you know, he doesn't have a problem finding one, he has a problem set, you know, going with one, running with the ball. So he exemplifies how perfectionism can seriously interfere with any decision-making process, including shidduchim. He was raised in an extremely critical family. A nice example of this, he told me 2 weeks ago, was he missed being valedictorian by 1 point. So he's shattered. This was like the worst thing in the world that can happen. He comes to his father, you know, looking for a little bit of support, and saying, you know, the reason why I didn't make it is, remember the one test I had, I was sick the week before, and therefore I couldn't prepare properly. And his father says, there's no excuse for failure. I will tell you, I didn't comb through my files through years of patients to find these examples. You know, this happens quite frequently. This is all from recent patients. Every minor imperfection in his home was magnified and not forgiven. Being human and having feelings was not accepted as an excuse for being imperfect. In his attempts to be perfect, he learned to repress his feelings and tried to act and be like a well-oiled precision instrument. Now, being disconnected from your feelings is a fatal flaw in the decision-making process. If you think about it, even if you go to buy a house or a car, right? Now, you could have three houses that are quite suitable for your needs, and each one can have certain milas and chesrinas, certain advantages and disadvantages. How do you decide? You go with your feelings. You know, of course, you know, you use your mind to narrow it down to choices that make sense for you, the right location, right price, but then you go with your feelings, right? Now, any decision, now certainly when you're going to get married, you can go out with a few people who are suitable candidates, who fit the requirements, right? So you have to go with your feelings. I saw once in a sefer, and if anybody knows where it is, please tell me, because I so much wanted to find it again. I, for the life of me, couldn't trace it back. I thought it was in Rav Dessler, but it wasn't. Then I thought maybe in the Stipler, but I can't find it. If anybody ever seen this, but I remember seeing in a sefer, he says, you know, they say you have to find the basheret. So a friend of mine once asked me, like, what in the world does that help us? I know there's a lottery ticket out there that has $10 million too, but what does it help you? I don't know where it is. You know, so what does it help knowing something's basheret if there's nothing that indicates where it is? So what is the meaning of all that? So I saw. Well, it's interesting that the truth is a Rambam says we don't pass in that way, that I blame Yom Kippur, so blah, but that's not for now. But what's interesting is, so the answer I saw in the Sefer is basheret is the one that you have the feelings for. That is a simon, that's basheret. You know, somebody who according to objective criteria is a suitable candidate, then you go with your feelings. Now, if you're not connected to your feelings, you have nothing to go with. So how do you make it? How do I know for sure this is the right one? Right? You know, because you have the right feelings, but if you're not connected to them, then how do you make a decision? Now, of course, besides the point, somebody that's raised in a house where every minor flaw is magnified, you know, is obviously going to find flaws. You know, when we tell somebody who's having a difficult time finding a shirk, they're being too picky, that's really a mistake. It's because they see things that you don't see. Right? To them, what they're seeing is not a minor detail. To them, they didn't live that way. They lived in their house. The most minor detail was magnified 1,000 times. So the parents who are criticizing them for being picky are sometimes, perhaps, had something to do with it. Well, let's try to examine now the dynamics of perfectionism. Oh, incidentally, this is based on a paper in this journal Psychotherapy that's going to be coming out in August. I have copies of the proof pages, yes. So if after this whole thing is over, if anybody's interested in a copy, I'll be happy to give you one. Okay, now perfectionism is usually associated with two diagnostic criteria. One is obsessive compulsive disorder, where the person tries to have his actions and behaviors be perfect. And then with narcissism, where the person tries to become a perfect person, where the perfection is within the person himself. Also, as I mentioned regarding Dr. Sarno, a lot of chronic pains could be associated with the stress involved in trying to be perfect all the time. Now, the difference, I think, between a perfection... Now, we all know there's something wonderful. You know, in Judaism, we have the thing about shleimus and striving, right? And striving for excellence. So what's the difference between trying to be perfect and striving for excellence? Now, I think the difference is that somebody who's striving for excellence is driven by a desire for success, right? And that's what's driving him. While somebody who is trying to be perfect is driven by a fear of failure. So somebody actually did such a study on athletes, a very interesting study. Now, how can you tell? Sometimes it's a little difficult to tell between the two. You can tell how the person deals with a less than perfect performance. If what's driving you is success, then if you did it 90%, that ain't bad, right? You're not going to be shattered from that because you're going toward your goal of excellence. But if you're being driven by fear of failure, if you have this horrible monster chasing after you, that if you do less than perfect, then you're a total failure, and it's a horrible narcissistic injury, then anything less than perfect is valueless. And that's how you can tell. Because if you're a teacher in a school, this is very common in Beis Yaakov schools, I know I've heard from some teachers, you know, when you give the girl a 98, and she comes up and she's crying like the most tragic thing just happened, that should give you a clue. Now, so where does this come from? Okay, so one of the things we'll talk about is parental influences. A lot of this is based on a literature review by Blatt in Sydney, I think it's written in Sydney, in the American Psychologist about 2 years ago. He had a comprehensive review. Parents of perfectionists tend to be a non-approving or inconsistently improving. The love is conditional on the child's performance. They're overly critical and demanding. Now, what happens is, unfortunately, I think like the young gentleman, whoever, the very moving speech presentation by the young gentleman from Ohel who spoke, you know, they're very inconsistent. They demand tremendously from the child, but not necessarily from the self at the same level. As I said there in my comment that I spoke, is that, you know, the biggest inconsistency of a parent is to be inconsistent and not accept your child's inconsistency. You know, obviously I don't know any parent who's consistent all the time, but at least accept it in your child too. Okay, now what happens if a child is criticized all the time for unreasonably? Then that creates in the child, not surprisingly, deep-seated feelings of inferiority, which can only be alleviated by being perfect. That's the solution. That's the cure for feeling terrible about yourself as being perfect and grand. Now, of course, since it's almost impossible to do almost all the time, so inevitably the less than perfect performances feeds the fires of inferiority feelings, which only raises the level of grandiosity. Another point is shame. Usually underlying perfection are pervasive feelings of shame. And that, and according, there's a wonderful book by Brosek in, about shame, where he writes about parents who treat children like objects rather than subjects. Right? And such a child becomes then, Miller, who quotes Brosek, writes what an obsessive compulsive child who went through such a overcritical upbringing, this is how she describes them. The self is viewed as a collection of functions that are adequately or improperly executed, and is viewed without regard for inner life as something to be recognized and valued. Now, the person doesn't look at himself as a person. He's not a whole person. He's a collection of different functions. You know, some that he does better than others. That's usually how they look in Shidduchim too when they go out. Is, you know, it's a collection of functions rather than a whole person. Okay, now the way this sometimes happens in some homes is what I call a double whammy. What happens, a parent is not sensitive to the child's feelings and therefore says something that's very hurtful to the child. The child has a normal reaction of being angry or sulking or something else, and the child is criticized for having that reaction. That is something I've heard over and over with patients who suffer from perfectionism. And they get, and basically the message they get, that having feelings in and of itself is very shameful. So then they try to become perfect. Get rid of all your feelings, then you can be perfect. There's also a lot of what many of these homes, the emphasis are on extrinsic values rather than intrinsic ones. There's a tremendous amount of fear of, I remember one kid told me that sometimes his house was like a zoo. Father was screaming, the place was going crazy. And the thing that was most important in such a situation is to do what? Close the window so the neighbors shouldn't hear. This also, for Miller, describes it very beautifully. She has a wonderful book on shame, and she writes, I think her first name is Susan Miller, and she writes like this, that in such a family, the child continually judges himself and others with a critical outsider's eyes, as if he's a thing, not a center of experiences. He seldom suspends such activity and seldom feels alive in the world. Every moment of sensation, analysis, or emotion is heavily overlaid with judgments about performance and appearance. An example of this is, I remember one youngster, this happened about a year ago, a teenager was telling me he was having such a horrible relationship with his mother, he hadn't spoken to her in about 5 months or something like that. Comes around Mother's Day, so, you know, so he thinks, I guess because he's been in therapy, something dawned on him, it doesn't make any sense to send a mushy Mother's Day card to your mother you haven't spoken to in 5 months. So he decided not to send it. We never even discussed it. I guess intuitively he understood it at this point. He comes to me in the next session, all upset. Man, did my father get mad at me? Boy, what a fight. I said, What happened? He says, you know, my father found out that I didn't send the Mother's Day card to my mother. He says, why you didn't send the Mother's Day card to your mother? He says, well, I don't know. It didn't seem to make much sense. We haven't been speaking to each other in the last few months. So what? What does it have to do with anything? You know how important for her a Mother's Day card is for her? Okay? So this gave him the message that they were more concerned with superficial appearance of a relationship than having a true relationship. Another major problem these children who come from these type of backgrounds is seeing pathology where there is none. There's an incredible study that was done by Strasberg in 97. If you pick up the article, it's referenced here. Incredible article. I think it has a lot to do with some of the problems of some of the parenting programs. You know, parenting programs teach techniques. But the question is what the parent is seeing. This study took vignettes. Let's say one example, I think, is illustrative of this. You see a vignette of a child playing. The mother tells the child, okay, it's time to go to bed. Oh, Ma, let me play for another 10 minutes, or, you know, until I finish the game. Mothers of aggressive boys will interpret that as being incredible chutzpah, non-compliance. That's like a horrible thing. What's even more amazing, and even more statistically significant, distinguishing mothers of aggressive boys from those who are not, is that they interpret it as with malicious intent. I'll never forget the mother told me about her infant. I wrote it down here, because I can't have to remember it. It's so wild. He said, he's manipulating me. She's so upset at this infant because he's manipulating her. So if you see things, if you interpret things in that way, there's some chairs over here. Come on. Of malicious intent, is it any wonder they react that way? Well, of course they're being very critical because, you know, that's like a normal reaction considering what you see. And it's important to understand that when you deal with such parents because they're perceiving things that are much different than what you're assuming. Okay, now, in some families of parents of perfectionists, the parents are very open about the perfection. Like the example I gave before about the kid who missed being valedictorian by 1 point. Parents told him, right, that's considered a failure. But most often, I hope anyways, that doesn't happen so blatantly. What usually happens in other cases, there's a sense of emotional neglect. And therefore, the children hope that by being perfect, they will merit the love and attention and consideration that they would like to have. I remember one youngster who actually wasn't very successful in therapy with. He was already had a few hospitalizations and was in heavy doses of medication by the time I saw him. But I remember he showed me a sefer that he once wrote. And, you know, this was going to do the trick. He's going to come home. His father was a Talmud Chacham. You know, he'll come bring him a sefer. Now, you know, if that doesn't do it, what is going to do it? Unfortunately, he didn't do it. Yeah, he showed it to me. I got to see it. Now, one unusual case, actually, just showing how this can come in different forms, is one youngster told me, no, my house criticism, no, my father hasn't stopped praising me from the day I was born. That's all I've heard was praise, praise, praise. And I'm thinking to myself, well, no, this doesn't fit in. I have to write a new paper. What's going on here? He says, and boy, do I hate it. Okay, so then we, of course, explored like what all that's about. And it turned out that his father is somebody with a tremendous undernourished sense of self, very difficult person, and he lived through his son vicariously, and the kid got the feeling, you know, subconsciously, that he has to be perfect in order to prevent the father from falling apart, and it absolutely drove him nuts, you know, that to feel that his behaviors is what's keeping the father together. Okay, now of course you can blame it on competitive schools and all that. That probably has something to do with too. But I think the kid has to be set up for it, because obviously not everybody in a competitive school is a perfectionist. So, you know, I don't think that's a complete explanation. Okay, now let's. What's unique about a religious adolescent? You know, how would this interact with religion? Well, the first obvious thing I think is that religion encourages people to be idealistic. Right, and to strive for goals. So if somebody's emotionally disposed or predisposed to be perfectionistic, this certainly would feed those feelings. Also, the people that the students are taught to emulate are presented as perfect beings. It's not my own original thought. This is Rav Huttner wrote in his Sefer. It's a well-known letter. It was once translated in the Jewish Observer in 1981. I'll read it. It's very interesting here. A failing many of us suffer from is that when we consider... This is Rav Huttner's words. A failing many of us suffer from is that when we consider the aspects of perfection of our sages, we focus on the ultimate level of their attainments. We discuss how they were complete in this or that area while omitting mention of the inner struggles that have previously raged within them. A listener would get the impression that these individuals came out of the hand of their creator as in full-blown form. Everyone is awed at the purity of speech of the Chafetz Chaim Zatzal, considering a miraculous phenomenon. But who knows of the battles, struggles, and obstacles, the slumps and the regressions that the Chafetz Chaim encountered in this war with his Yetzer Hara. The result of this failing is that when an ambitious young man of spirit and enthusiasm meets obstacles, fails, and falls in slumps, he imagines himself is unworthy of being planted in the house of Hashem. I actually spoke... No, I have to say this without the tape. I spoke to somebody who who was involved in this event, told me he got a lot of heat for writing. To write this on the Chafetz Chaim? Luckily, somebody found that Rav Yochanan said the same thing in a sefer, so he's off the hook. Anyways, when I wrote this, the editor of the journal wrote me back, but biblical figures are presented as flawed. I have to go explain to him the Gemara that says, no, you shouldn't think Taka they were flawed. It only means a few of them are Madrega, etc., etc. And also, I think people relate much more to Gedolim of the recent past than they do to Adam Arishan or, you know, David HaMelech. Another problem, I think, another issue is, I think, since Yiddishkeit stresses behavior a lot more than feelings and attitudes and beliefs, right? So it makes it easy for somebody who has emotional reasons to not be connected to their feeling, to devalue the issue of feelings. And I think that's a common thing. You know, you go to any PTA, if your kid is behaving and learning, the kid who told me he's bigger than Hashem was one of the most well-behaved kids in the school. And his mother would always tell me how she shocked. This kid's been in therapy, since he's five. You know, I was treating him and it was very slow progress. And his mother told me, every time I go to PTA, there's nothing for you to do here. He's a perfect kid. You know, he sits in class, he never bothers anybody. Of course, he never talked to anybody either. You know, never goes out to recess. He's always, you know, busy hiding from people by staying in the base medrash. But we don't value feelings very much or sufficiently. Not surprisingly, in an extensive review of the literature by Worthington in 1996, where he did a review of religion and psychotherapy, so he distinguishes intrinsically religious people who do it for who are into religion for intrinsic reasons, who get a mental health benefit from religion, with extrinsically motivated religious people for whom religion can sometimes cause emotional problems. So it's interesting. It's in the article. It's you get the reference. Now, healthy students, healthy religious students, tend to have benevolent parents, non-conflictual childhoods, a smooth religious developmental history, and real non-dramatic religious sentiments. In contrast, the more troubled students have conflict-laden childhoods and discontinuous religious commitments. Okay, that's not surprising. Now, of course, religious perfectionists, when they have problems, emotional problems, what do they tend to do? How do they deal with it? They become more religious. They intensify further, right? As Spiro wrote in a nice article in 95, he says, he put it very nicely, the disguise is generally transparent or the resolution only apparent and mediocre. I think we all know what that means. Another problem is the religion encourages guilt. You know, what is religion without guilt? Okay, now guilt has a bad rap in psychotherapy and then I guess psychology and certainly in psychoanalysis, but that, the truth is, guilt should not have a bad, guilt actually is very healthy. Al Shaklin, my professor in Furkoff, was totally not from, not Jewish or from or religious, said, guilt is a wonderful thing. I almost fell off my chair. I thought I'm supposed to be up to courses. Guilt is terrible. Like, what's going on here? No, guilt is wonderful, because if you have internalized values and you violate your own internal values, then being guilty is feeling guilty is the appropriate response. What we often call guilt is really shame. There's a big distinction between shame and guilt. Guilt refers to the person's is an external thing, being embarrassed what other people. Guilt is an internal thing, feeling you violated an internal standard or moral belief. While shame is really is being embarrassed from the other. In fact, Rabbi Ruchem says, it's brought down the Yalkut Lekachtayv. It's not referenced here. He says, Musag habusha shalanu haliba de'emes bizayon. What we call shame. Because we know that Klai Yisrael are baishanim. It's a very important thing. But that busha is not what we call shame. What we call shame is bizayon, is disgrace. Because what we're thinking about is how we're going to look in somebody else's eyes. That's not what the Torah means busha. The busha that the Chazal are talking about, which is a wonderful trait, is really what we call guilt. So that's a source of confusion. Another problem with helping somebody, what perfectionists often do, how does a perfectionist deal with the fact that he knows he's really doing some pretty awful things sometimes? So what often happens with a perfectionist, because they're trying to get rid of those terrible feelings, but of course, as we know, they don't go away. Very often you get a split, what Coates spoke called the vertical split, dissociative aspects of the self. So on one hand, these people could be flying high, the best in the yeshiva, learning day and night, and sometimes they can do the most awful things. There's a case example in here. We're not going to have time to go, but there's a case example here that's really a composite of a few different people, but very, really it's true to life. Because what happens is the perfectionism actually, for a while, it actually helps you get better. It's a wonderful thing being perfect, trying to be perfect, because it raises your level of performance until your emotions eventually catch up with you. Another problem is because the parents are often very overcritical over minor things, it makes it very difficult for a perfectionist to distinguish between different levels of badness. Somebody once wrote a wonderful article, in America, every injustice is today called the Holocaust. You ever notice that? The animal rights people call about the Holocaust of the chickens in McDonald's. Right? So every injustice in the world is called the Holocaust. Right? And he says it's a terrible thing because there's different levels now. There's a lot of injustices in the world, but not all of them merit being called the Holocaust. And you have to distinguish between different levels. You cheapen the word Holocaust if you use it for some minor evil. So the same thing when all behaviors are criticized, a parent will come in, terribly distraught. Got this terrible problem with my kid. How old's your kid? 5 years old. What's a terrible problem? God, what did he do? He's a liar. You can't believe. I asked him, did you take the candy? He said, no, he's going to grow up to be an Al Capone. This is terrible. Help me, doctor. Right? So you don't distinguish between different levels of problems. Right? So therefore the person himself internalizes this, and therefore he can't deal with any aspect of badness in himself, and basically they dissociate these bad feelings, and they live like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They live a double life. On one hand, they're striving for perfection, and because they get rid of their bad feelings, it actually works pretty well for a while. Until it catches up with you, it actually looks good. And that brings us to the problem of doing therapy with perfectionists. The problem is, because you're asking them to give up something that they see as really their only saving grace, right? Being that the underlying self-image is horrible, right? Below zero. So what do they have going for them is that they're spending their whole lives striving to be perfect and even better. They feel horrible when they're not perfect. So what could be better than that? And trying to change that, what are you offering them in return? You'll be in touch with your feelings. Whoa, that's going to go over big, right? I mean, they don't really value that very much. All they really want from you, what they're coming for you, is to get them back on track to be able to be perfect again. And the solution to that, I think it was also Dr. Goldwasser, right, from Miami. He said it from the Chafetz Chaim, but I told him afterwards, there's a maral that says it even sharper. You know, there's the maral, you know, the Pasuk in Bereishis says that Hashem first told the earth to bring forth an eighth pri, a fruit tree that bears fruit. The earth then listened and brought forth whatever that means. The maral explains that, I don't have a clue what he's talking about. And he says, instead, the earth brought forward a tree that bears fruit. Rashi brings a medrash. That what does that mean? That originally the tree itself was supposed to have the taste of the fruit. Okay, so what does all that mean? So Maral explains that the tree is the process and the fruit is the goal. And originally, the sense of satisfaction, the geschmack that a person got out of the process was supposed to be the same as the fruit. The earth didn't listen, so we don't have that same feeling. He said our job is to fix that chet, to fix that omission, and to develop the ability to enjoy the process as much as the goal itself. He said a similar vart, I think, from Chassam Seifer, from somebody else. So what's the idea is, if you can help the person connect to the idea of the importance of process, so that's the opposite of perfectionism. Because a perfectionist has absolutely no interest in anything to do with process. He's only fixated on the goal. But how did one patient tell it to me? He says, you don't understand. How can I be proud of a step towards solving my problem when I'm not ready yet to admit that I have a problem? Now, with religious youngsters, very often, if you ask them, let's say if you try to get into this, so you ask them, tell me, do you enjoy your learning? Inevitably, you'll get this reaction. Do I enjoy my learning? What, are you crazy? Of course I enjoy my learning. I mean, how can you even ask me such a question? And they're telling you what they really think. They're not lying. They're not, you know, embarrassed to say that they're not. Because non-perfectionists are not embarrassed to tell you that they don't enjoy the learning. They'll come and tell you that's their problem. But if you look into it, if you really examine it closely with the patient, what you'll find is what they're enjoying is not having to feel guilty or shame not learning. They don't see the difference. The difference in the beginning is way beyond them. In other words, what they're enjoying, they have this monster chasing after them. And they know if when they're not learning like they're supposed to, they're horrible. They feel like totally devastated, full of shame. So what they're really enjoying, what they interpret as enjoying learning, is enjoying not having to feel horrible. That doesn't keep you going for a long time. Another problem is that, you know, the building self-esteem is a very hot issue these days, right? Now, normally when you try to help a child develop self-esteem, you're starting with a blank slate. He doesn't feel negative or positive. It's a little easier for the parent to build up self-esteem. With these patients, the problem is already you're filling a black hole. They're below zero, right? So they need grand. It's very hard for them to feel a sense of satisfaction from every, you know, therapy is a slow, agonizing process, as we all know. And for them to feel a sense of gratification and growth from these small steps just doesn't do it, because it doesn't get rid of the horrible feelings. And this is one of the difficult things in therapy with the patients. As far as the issue of religious therapists or non-religious therapists, you know, it's interesting, some of these patients will ask for a non-religious therapist. Because speak to somebody who they feel might be judgmental. What's interesting, a Rav once called me up and had a patient with some similar problems, and he said, you know, he's asking, or I don't remember if he said it, his suggestion, or he said it in the name of the patient or himself, that maybe better if he go to a non-religious therapist because he'd feel more comfortable. So I explained to him, I think this is true. I said, I don't think it's going to work. Because it's true the therapist will be non-judgmental, but this guy's going to be thinking to himself, oh, of course he's non-judgmental. He doesn't even understand what the problem is. What's the big deal? If he would know or understand how bad it is, he'd also be judgmental. So I think it's necessary to have a religious therapist who can help the patient understand, like, what's the underlying symptom, you know, underlying causes for this, and what happened in the history of his life that brought this about, so that the being non-judgmental will be meaningful to the patient. In conclusion, in treating religious perfectionists, the challenge is to help them recognize and resolve the psychological issues underlying the perfectionism without causing them to feel compelled to abandon the religious beliefs so central to their personal world. This can best be done by replacing the illusory grandiosity or perfection with a gratification from real, albeit modest, achievements. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ben Sion, for really an almost perfect discussion of perfectionism.
I worked hard to make it perfect.
What's that? We're running behind. Let's do it afterwards. We're going to take questions afterwards.
So I can say, as you were speaking about a child who feels the need for perfectionism, almost all the examples you brought back to what was in the home from the parents. But sometimes children are self-determined by what they see from their peers.
Self-driven
to perfectionism from what they see from their peers. A class of 30 children, if a child sits day in and day out in school and sees that the three children at the top of the class are treated differently by the other children in the class, by the teachers, and by their friends, they can become motivated to go on that path without any encouragement from the home.
Yeah. Okay, clearly it's true, I mentioned sort of in passing, that obviously a very competitive school could certainly have an effect. But I still, my experience has been, I can only speak from my experience, I once spoke to parents, this was many years ago, of a child who was somewhat learning disabled. Had difficulty concentrating and focusing. Unfortunately, it was spoken about a lot with the troubled kids, a lot of times that's the source of the problem. And parents spoke to me when he was quite young. I think he was in early grades of elementary school, and they were troubled by it. And they asked me, what are we supposed to do? So I told them, listen, I'm not a specialist in learning disabilities. I can refer you to somebody. You may have to get him a tutor. You have to deal with the learning disability, whatever you can do. I said, my feeling about your job as parents is to protect them, to protect his feelings. Because he'll grow, unless it's a severe learning disability, they grow out of a lot of this stuff. But he might be destroyed by that time. And while it's true you have insensitive teachers and you have insensitive schools, I don't think a kid ever cares as much about how somebody feels about him or her as the parents. It might bother him an insensitive teacher. It might bother him an insensitive student. And, I'm sure if there's too many of them, it'll overwhelm anything the parent can do. It's certainly possible. But very often, if a kid feels that his parents are on his side and that they feel he's doing the best he can and don't put him down, I think most often there are exceptions, he will survive. This particular kid, I recently met his parents, and they were telling me that he did wonderfully. He was never the best kid in the class. He always struggled, but he was never embarrassed from it. He wasn't embarrassed to have kids who were younger than him for help. And he stayed functioning very, very well. So, I can't disagree with you. Obviously, it would be wonderful. Everybody's sensitive and wouldn't have all this competitiveness. But I still believe that the kid feels... What happens, I think, often, parents start off that way, but they get bombarded from the schools. If the principal is calling you every day, and the teacher is calling you every day, says, you know what your kid's doing. He's not trying hard enough. I think we get overwhelmed by it, and we sometimes pass it on, that pressure, onto the kid unknowingly. That's the best answer I can give you.
I should repeat the question. I forgot my own instruction.
What suggestions do I have for educators, principals, teachers to have to comply with, state regulations of certain number of, cutting certain curricula, cutting material for exams, having four marking periods in the school, 10 subjects, each subject needs 2 tests per semester, so you have students taking 20 tests in a period of 2 or 3 months. And this is despite parents' efforts to encourage children to be studying, to learning, and not just getting 100, getting into the IVs. But what might principals and teachers do to encourage learning and growth and academic achievement without turning students into, lives packages before they get AIDS?
Are you addressing that specifically to Dr. Sorotskin, or?
I guess what I was talking about.
I think we can't be oblivious to reality. But I think even in that, I remember I once worked with a youngster whose Rebbe was incredible. Mesiras Nefesh, I was astonished. I mean, I wasn't really that surprised because the manal of that particular school was very similar. And I remember this kid was just totally impossible. The Rebbe did everything he could possibly do and he had to throw him out. But he did it so wonderfully. And I said to him, look, I'd love to help you. I can't. I have a whole class. I can't do this. I have to send you somewhere else. But I want to continue my kesher with you. He kept on inviting him for Shabbos. He lent him money for his to go to college because the parents wouldn't help. He did everything with his kid. And Baruch Hashem, I met him about a few months ago. He was doing very well. So even, you have to deal with reality. But if you don't put the kid in, I think what often happens is any kid who's having trouble in life, mostly school at this age, and I ask him, why do you think you have this problem? It's either 100% or 99.9. I'm not sure. Well, ask me because I'm lazy. inevitably. And I think that is the... And they got it from somebody. And it's true, the schools may have given to them, but I think sometimes the parents go along with it out of frustration because they have it over their heads. But if you tell the kid, look, I know you're not lazy. You're trying the best you can. You have a problem with something. I'm not sure what it is. And I'll do my best to help you. I'll get you a tutor. I'll work with you. Whatever it is, I think that will make the big difference.
My question is, in terms of schools that have different levels, I went to a high school that wasn't just levels within your class, but it was the whole school. And the way of promoting perfectionism, the way of promoting executing goodwill, there was always also, after ninth grade or tenth grade, it was like more from so that even though if you think that you're advancing, it's only if you're adding more, so it's not, you know?
The question then is, schools that have different levels, how does it affect the kids, or maybe it drives, it may encourage a kid toward perfectionism because he constantly has to achieve, you know, keep up with the levels. It's basically the same answer. You know, I'm not sure, it's an old debate in education, whether it's good idea or not idea, you know, the mainstreaming, having different groups or different people, I wouldn't even try to touch that. So, you know, I'm not sure I'm really the person to answer even to address that question. But since that's the reality, I think it's the same question, it's similar to the issue of labeling. You know, one of the presentations about kids off the derech, so there was like someone of the presenters who's a very sensitive person, has done a lot to help these kids, but like, you know, we're going to have a new label. You know, we're going to call them disturbed kids, we're going to call them disadvantaged kids. I don't think it makes a difference. The kid knows he has a problem. It's like the problem of sending a kid to therapy. Many parents, you know, are concerned about the kids. I don't want to send him to therapy because he's going to be labeled. My God, the kid doesn't know he has a label. He might not sure what he calls it. Thomas Saz wrote years ago in The Myth of Mental Illness that, you know, they used to call them crazy. Then they figured it's not really nice to call people crazy, we call them insane. That became not nice, and you call them mentally ill. That's not nice either. Now there's something challenged, right? It's a problem. The kid knows he has a problem. He knows he's not getting anywhere. And I think the way we help him is not by changing the label, but by explaining the label to him. You know, it's not, again, not making feels because he's lazy, and it's not because he doesn't care. 90% of the kids have been told, if only you would try harder, you would do better. Why? Because Chazal say that, right? It happens to be there is absolutely no such Chazal. I've checked it with many Gedolim besides the computer. There is no such Chazal, right? But we tell it to kids all the time. Rav Volbo told me there's no such Chazal. Somebody asked for Pinchas Schreiberg. He says there's no such Chazal. My computer says there's no such Chazal, right? So, and I think, so the answer is, maybe it is a good idea to have tracks, maybe it isn't a good idea. But I think if the kid is in a lower track, and the feeling the parents give him, you're doing the best you can, we're perfectly happy the way you are, if you need any extra help, we're happy to help you. You don't have to be in the highest track, I don't need it for my ego, I don't need to tell Bubby you're in the highest track, if it's a problem with Bubby, it's her problem, I'm not going to make it your problem, then I think it doesn't have to be a major problem. Yeah.
I'd like to share a point, and I'm only doing it because I'm sure my English is better than your Portuguese, so excuse me for my mistake. About perfectionism, when I have a maxim that I use with my patients that works very well, because you said how difficult it is for them to give up their perfectionism is the only thing they have. So I try to negotiate with them that maybe 90% of perfectionism is a very good thing. So if you give up 10% of perfectionism, so don't you agree that a thing that is 90% good is very good? So everyone agrees that it's good. No, well, it's good. So if you give up 10% of your perfectionism, not 100%, you don't need to give up 100% of your, only 10%. So you will gain 100% of more, of being more relaxed and more happy and everything. So it's a good deal. And it works.
Yeah.
And a question about perfectionism and women. If you think it's, there is something particular on our roles and our the lives we are living. And to you also a question about, these boundaries that it's so easy to break with the Orthodox patients of our own community, and maybe you will explain a little bit more.
Maybe you want to start with that first? Are you sure, Michan? Okay. The bargaining, I mean, definitely that is the goal. I mean, the difficulties, I'm sure, since you're dealing with it, have seen is to them 90% is not 90%. 90% for them is zero. Of course, you know, usually it's not that bad, so, you know, you can start, and that is what usually I try to do. I try to help them make that transition. The problem is, another problem I didn't actually mention, but it's related to what you're saying. A patient just happened just a week ago. He's made a tremendous strides in giving up his perfectionism, but he's beginning to realize that much of what he's achieved before was neurotic. And this is killing him, you know, and he said he feels he's reborn now in a way positive because he feels like a child of when he started being perfectionistic. It was quite dramatic. I usually don't get it that dramatic, but this is about a week ago. Again, he knew I was probably coming to speak about this, so he could help me. And he said, like, you know, he feels like he's 9 years old from when this started. And on one hand, it's wonderful because, you know, he feels like he's like a natural person again. But on the other hand, my God, what'd I do all those years? And I find that I have to bargain on that too. Well, listen, it is good. You did achieve a lot. You've learned a lot. You know, it's not valueless. You know, maybe you didn't do it for the best motivations, but it's not, you almost have to like sort of cushion the fall. And so there's a transition between keeping something from before while you go into the new phase without doing it too. But they're so used to doing things 100% that it's hard for them to think in terms of transition. So it makes it difficult, but certainly that's what you aim for.
Self-compassion in your patients as an antidote to the perfectionism?
That's a good question. How to engender them self-compassion. Yes. I saw that Revolver writes in one of his svarim that the same way you have to learn to have patience for others, you need to learn to have patience for yourself. One of the ways I do it, you really summed up the challenge, and they're so far from their minds having self-compassion that you know, it's...
You need that quality.
Yes, right? Because it's a feeling. It's seen as a weakness. It's seen as being an imperfection, right? Because they have to think of themselves. The fact that they think they need compassion is already a terrible narcissistic blow. So it's something they struggle with. And I think, you know, what happens is, I think what allows them to drop it is the fact that they stop, you know, when they see the history of it, how it developed, it allows them to stop blaming themselves. Of course, they most often begin by blaming the parents. Okay, but I find that to be a transitional stage. What's amazing, the ones who go through the whole process develop, as they develop more compassion from themselves, they begin to understand where the parents are coming from. You know, they begin to understand the pressures they were under, and although sometimes parents get very nervous about it and feel like, you know, they're being bashed and everything like that, but it is a transition. First, there's the pressure that comes off the kid. The kid feels a little bit more compassion toward himself, doesn't need to be perfectionistic. They begin to start functioning at a higher level, and that makes them easier to be compassionate of other people. So.